Shrink Wrap Radio number 417, A Jungian Understanding of Crop Circles, with Gary S. Bobroff.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Gary S. Bobroff, M.A., the author of Crop Circles, Jung, and the Reemergence of the Archetypal Feminine, and the producer of the upcoming Synchronicity Symposium to be held in Joshua Tree, California, September 12 through the 14th of 2014. You can find out more about Gary Bobroff by visiting our show notes for this episode on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Gary S. Bobroff, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here, David.
Well, I'm so glad to have you on. I only recently became aware of your work, and I have a strategic partnership with Bonnie Bright of the Depth Psychology Alliance, and she let me know about the upcoming Synchronicity Symposium that you've put together. And in as much as I'm always interested in synchronicity, I put a link to your conference on our site, and I thought it'd be a good idea for us to talk.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's a real nice match between your listeners and our event, and it's, you know, it's a deeply psychological event. So,
yeah, that's great. And we can talk about your upcoming Synchronicity Symposium at some length later in this interview. However, I understand that you also have a book that will be released in just a matter of days. Is that right? Days?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's next Thursday, August 19th, it comes out.
Oh, wow. And I think this interview will go out on the same day.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So, and the book is about Jung and crop circles. So I'd like to start out by focusing on that. And I must confess that I know nothing about the crop circle phenomenon other than that some people have linked them to extraterrestrial landings. And so I think I more or less dismissed them out of hand. Probably not a good thing to do. So how did you come to be interested in the crop circle phenomenon?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of people in the 90s, I was just sort of interested in them in a general way, not in a psychological way, and just observing them and in the 90s and kind of, you know, keeping my eye on it somewhat since then. And then at Easter weekend 2000, I was studying at Pacifica and I had this inspiration, I guess. I was reading Answer to Job by Jung. I was actually reading The Creation of Consciousness by Edinger, which is about Jung's Answer to Job and our relationship to, you know, the transpersonal or the divine or the bigger picture, whatever you want to call it, whether it's metaphysical or not. And just was inspired about crop circles as a kind of a modern way that we're, you know, thinking about, you know, the rest of the world or the bigger picture.
Interesting. And so, yeah, we didn't say anything about you having been at Pacifica, but you did get your master's degree there. And I read that you were maybe going to go on to a PhD program. Are you in the midst of that or is that on the agenda?
It's on the agenda, but things like this conference keep coming up to keep me from.
So you're one of these people that creates a lot of work for yourself, huh?
I guess so. We'll see where the universe wants me to be. So.
Yeah. Now I haven't seen your book yet, but I have the impression that you include references to archival documents showing that crop circles have been around for centuries. Do I have that right?
Yeah, chapter one of the book, and it's called Crop Circles, Jung, and the Reemergence of the Archetypal Feminine. Chapter one is science, so we look at, you know, the scientific evidence we have that there's a genuine phenomenon, of which there's 10 different categories that we go through. And chapter two is the history, and there's clearly archival evidence taking crop circles at least 350 years back, if not further. And, you know, there's always been a little bit of speculation that, you know, if they have been going on for centuries, that maybe they were the original inspiration for the stone circles that dot the landscape throughout England, and that perhaps the stone circles were there to kind of hold the energy that people feel sometimes when they're in an actual crop circle over there. Oftentimes there's a very palpable feeling. And in fact, we know that in some of them there's actual, you know, measurable electromagnetic energy. Even in ones, you know, there's archival documents from the 1970s from Canada of crop circles that were measured by folks, you know, with a provincial geologist on hand, that showed, you know, high electromagnetic readings even after weeks of rain in the area of a crop circle. So we know that there's a palpable energy, and perhaps it goes back, you know, thousands of years even to the beginning of the stone circle phenomenon out there.
Well, you know, what you're saying about the magnetic energy makes me wonder if the magnetic field could somehow be creating the circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, people generally feel like, you know, when we have discussions in general about what's making crop circles, there's three categories that are kind of useful for sort of feeling out the process. And one of them is earth energies, like you're saying, that somehow the earth is involved in the process. And, you know, I have no idea how that would work causally, and I'm not trying to solve this mystery. I'm trying to deepen our participation with it as one would with a dream. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the earth is one category, and the aliens is another category, and spirit on some level, some way, is another category. So most folks, when they're talking about what might be making the phenomenon, they talk about those three things and in some fashion. And, you know, the agency part for me is, like I said, I like to leave that as a mystery. And, you know, that's something that we don't do enough in our time, is we always want to solve. And I think that's part of, you know, what I call the over-masculine imbalance of our era, that we're too lost in solutions and needing to have the answers all the time, even when we're faced with a gigantic mystery, you know.
Yeah, and I'm somebody who, I guess it's the mystery that draws me to Jung in general. And but let me play Philistine here, and I've already confessed that I'm had a bias about extraterrestrials, and I hope I've not offended. It doesn't sound like I've offended you in doing so.
Oh.
But what do you think is making crop circles, and, you know, what might be their significance?
Well, like I said, I don't spend too much time really thinking about the what is making them, because I have no way of knowing. But the significance, you know, it's like a dream. We're depth-oriented people. We're Jungian people. I'm certainly consider myself, you know, from the Jungian tradition. And so when it comes to this, that's really what my whole book is about, is what is the significance. So I look at it as though the world was the dreamer, or the Western world is the dreamer, and this is the dream, you know, crop circles. And we have these two essential elements, and one is crop and one is circle. You know, the phenomenon occurs in living grain. The plants are not, you know, are still alive after the formation comes down. So in our tradition, in our psyche, you know, we have this connection to living plants and to grain in particular as a symbol of the feminine, that there's a connection between the miracle of life and grain and the feminine. And this is all woven together in the world and in our psyche. And here we are at this time where we have so tremendously and horribly lost the archetypal feminine, lost the miracle of life, lost our connection to where our food comes from, lost our connection to valuing the planet. You know, there's a powerful thing we do in Jungian psychology that James Hillman liked to do a lot, which was, you know, look at the origin of words. And, you know, the word materialism, of course, mater means, you know, both matter and mother.
Mm-hmm.
And in our society, we're lost in this materialism, and it's a compulsive, a shadow expression of our thirst for the archetypal mother, for the sacred divine in us and in all of us. And, you know, it's really clear that we've lost the feminine, and that's how we're able to destroy our world. And here's this mystery that's in that media. And I think, you know, any time that we can have a phenomenon that allows us to consider or participate with the archetypal feminine in a mysterious fashion, in a way that evokes us, I think we should do so. And that's the direction I go in the book, is how might we play with the meaningfulness of this phenomenon in the direction of the feminine.
Okay, one of the things I found myself wondering is when to date this loss of the feminine that you're referring to, and whether or not that would sync up with the appearance of crop circles.
Ah, yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just something that kind of popped into my mind as I was considering, you know, the you sent me something about the background of the book. Moving along, though, the circle, of course, brings to mind, and something that you explore very much, is the idea of the mandala, and the mandala as a symbol of the self. So maybe you could wax eloquent about that for a bit.
Well, you know, crop circles aren't all circles, but we call them crop circles, and that's significant. But they also tend to be centered around a point. They tend to be much like the mandala, like a church window. You know, they tend to be, you know, geometrically, you know, balanced and beautiful. And, you know, there is the element of sacred art to be found in them, as we do find in our traditional sacred art. And so, you know, into this world, which is profoundly imbalanced, which is profoundly tilted, as I said, in the direction of the masculine, much to our loss and to our gain. We had to go through the phase to get there, but now it's too much. Into this profoundly imbalanced time, as Jung talked about, you know, he said, you know, one of the, you know, key defining features of our time is that we, you know, prefer masculine, archetypally masculine approaches over archetypally feminine ones. And so we're imbalanced. And here is the self, you know, here's the mandala, a symbol of balance regained in this mystery. And I think that's one of the key pieces to think about, is that, you know, as a message to us, that, you know, that here's this part of its expression is this, you know, the symbol of return to balance and return to health. That the mandala represents. And again, I think it's about regaining the feminine, at least in part, the message here. And, you know, we know what the self is about in Jungian psychology. You know, the mandala is always taking us to, you know, that inner place of knowing the greater, the inner place of knowing the transpersonal, the timeless in ourselves. And again, that's something we've lost too. You know, our society is so focused on the now and on the moment and no sense of the eternal. In fact, John Ralston Saul has a great line about, you know, our focus on efficiency, on being the most efficient, is the way that we shadow express our inner drive for the eternal, and that we're like a bird flapping our wings with nowhere to land because we can never ground. And then here we have in crop circles this symbol of, you know, that in us which knows the sacred art, the self expressed in this new artistic way. So, you know, again, it's something for us to ponder and consider and go more deeply as we're in this time, which is, you know, lost.
Have you visited crop circles? Have you flown over them or walked through them?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have. I've been to crop circles in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And, you know, it's quite a powerful thing when you find one that you can actually feel a real energy in. I was in one of the best ones ever was my first one. It was 1,000 feet across, 409 circles, perfect fractal geometry. This is a Milk Hill 2001 formation. And it, you know, was so vast and precise that experienced crop circle explorers said it took them a half an hour to find the middle, to find the center. And that was my first one, and it was quite wonderful to be at that one. But by the time I got there, there had been probably, you know, 1,000 or several thousand people had gone through it, and I didn't feel the energy as strongly as perhaps I wanted to. And I found myself a few weeks later in Canada alone in a new formation that had just come down a few days before. And I was in it, you know, walking it, following the lay of the wheat myself, and could really palpably feel the energy, and actually became disoriented, which is not something that I ever, you know, ever happens to me. And so, you know, it's funny how you can be in the most grand thing and perhaps, you know, not quite pick it up, but, you know, find another humble experience somewhere else and have a real strong sense of it. So, you know, it's quite marvelous to go in them and look at the wheat for yourself and find, you know, unbroken plants that are bent. A lot of them have, you'll find in some places a 90-degree bend at the root node where the plant isn't broken, it's not snapped, but that there's actually a fused 90-degree bend near the bottom of the plant in a genuine formation. Not all of them, but you will find them occasionally. And that's just, you know, the fun of it. And then, you know, I was in one this summer playing with dowsing rods and exploring the energy of it, and really was a sort of a joyous feeling after you get through the kind of critical mind place where you're, oh, is it real? Is it not real? Once you kind of get through that and you're satisfied for yourself, there's an experience of joy and wonder that can come along. And I've experienced that. It's neat to be in something that feels special. You know?
Yeah. Now, from what you said that you arrived at this second one that you were just talking about shortly after it had formed. Does that mean that they form and go away, and that there are constantly new ones and some coming, some going away?
Yeah, they get harvested. Often they arrive in the summer usually, or early summer, but most often towards the end of the growing season is when they tend to arrive, and so that they'll get harvested. So it's just more that the energy really can dissipate, especially when you've had a lot of people. The Milk Hill 2001 one that I was in was quite wonderful, and I'm sure there was, you know, some energy still there. But being in another one, a more humble one in Saskatchewan, where, you know, I was maybe the third or fourth, fifth person that was in it, and it was only a few days old. You know, that was very energetically palpable to me, and I'm a little bit skeptical myself always, David, like you, and you know, I need to be satisfied. And when you can actually feel something quite clearly in your body, you know, it helps you get over that. And they don't go away as much as they'll get harvested up. And I think the energy can kind of, you know, move away a little bit over time. And so that's how that unfolds.
Okay. Yeah, they get harvested. It's like, duh, I should have thought of that.
Well, it's quite interesting too, because some of them are, you know, they're laid flat, so you can't get all the seed up. You know, you can't you can't combine it, you can't harvest it, you can't get that wheat off the ground because they're so low. And so sometimes what happens is the seed from the crop circle wheat stays on the ground, and it will actually, you know, plant and grow next year. And so there's this phenomenon that people notice where there's like a shadow of greater growth in the area where the formation was. And one of the bits of the science is they actually see that the you'll find in the seed head, there's actually expansion in the cell wall so that more energy can transfer through. So when they've germinated seeds from authentic crop circles, they will find greater growth. So you can, it depends when the formation comes down in the growing season. If it comes down at the end of the year, they find greater growth. If it comes down too early, they find no growth because the seeds are malformed. But so if it comes down late in the year, you can get a shadow where the whole formation area kind of grows taller. The plants are bigger and stronger than the rest of the field in that area. So you'll see like a raised circle or whatever the shape of the formation was, which is, you know, another neat reminder that something is definitely going on.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. Now, the Milk Hill one, is that also in Canada?
No, that's in England.
Okay. Yeah. So you've mentioned UK, Canada, and I think the US. Was the US the third one?
That's the third one that I've been to.
Okay.
They're worldwide.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask, if they're worldwide, and is it only with wheat, or are there other crops that...
No, there's a great one in 2008 in Korea that was in rice, and they do get them in Asia in rice, and different, it's all kinds of, you can have it in grass or barley or different kinds of food grain or, you know, like I said, in just vegetation and grass. Mostly it's in harvestable crops, but like I said, rice or barley or you know, canola, you know, the different grains that folks grow. And Europe has actually been quite a bit of a hotbed in the last couple of years. There have been really wonderful ones in Germany and Italy and France and Poland and Czech Republic. And there are certain sort of geological signatures that have to be in place. But more or less, it's worldwide. It's not every country, obviously, in the world, but it is sort of wrapping all around the globe.
How do crop circles relate to the topic of synchronicity?
Well, you know, I do a chapter in my book called "The Reality of the Psyche," which some folks will remember is a book title in the Jungian Library by Wheelwright and. So what I write about in the book is synchronicity and the things we know about quantum physics and the relationship of subject and object in our world, and also Rupert Sheldrake's work. And, you know, the thing that I think the way that they're related is things such as there's this phenomenon that happens throughout the history of crop circles in the modern era from the, you know, Colin Andrews, one of the first famous researchers through to today, including people I know, where things will happen when they are emotionally involved with their research. So Colin has said famously, or not that famously, but he has said, recounted his story of one year in the 80s, he could no longer afford to travel to study this phenomenon. And he sort of cried out to the heavens, and he was, you know, he was emotionally present with it, saying, you know, I just can't afford to go and chase these things all over England. And he ended up getting one close to his home within a short period of time. And,
great.
You know, there's other synchronicities like Colin Andrews and a pilot were flying over an area and they talked about, oh, what would be neat is if we saw this kind of design that we saw combined with the Celtic cross. And then within a short period of time, they found that design roughly in the area of where they had been flying. Now, another example is one of the key researchers was in Holland, staying at a farm where they regularly get formations, and she recounts a story of going to bed one night after having had a discussion with the landowner about why can't this phenomenon be more direct? You know, why can't we stop this pussyfooting around and just, you know, be more direct? And she was emotionally activated, and you could see that in the story. And that night, her and the farmer had an eyewitness experience where they actually saw the formation come down, and there was a light pillar that they saw. And for me, you know, Jung talked very clearly about the role of feeling and synchronicity, and he talks about feeling as psychic mass. Feeling as psychic mass, the measurement of something's value to us. And so, you know, synchronicity is a very amazing phenomenon, especially for our sort of reductionist ingrained worldview that we have. But what it teaches us is that there's these ways that feeling can make or acausally, it's not make, but are acausally related to events in our world. And you know, there's the famous story of Jung and Freud when Freud is saying, oh, you know, don't get me involved with all that kind of mystical mumbo jumbo. And Jung knows there's going to be this, you know, loud retort, this loud sound. And it comes and they both get a little freaked out. And Jung expressed feeling this, all this energy in his abdomen before it came, building up and building up with the unspoken protest against Freud's restriction of him. And after the first sound, he said, it's going to happen again, and it did. So there's a way that feeling is involved with the world in this mysterious way, and I'm not trying to deify crop circles. I'm just saying the whole of our existence is encased in a web of feeling that we're beginning to explore through our experience.
That's a nice way of putting it, and certainly I've had my own experiences of that sort of thing, and I'm also aware of parapsychological research, and it seemed like feeling played an important role in successful tests of telepathy and so on, that if there was an emotional connection or tie, for example, lots of reports of mothers whose son was killed in the war and they wake up in the middle of the night, just boom, you know, they're aware that something has happened to their child. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of anecdotal information such as that. And
yeah. And
I know in terms of my own, I know this is true for authors also in terms of some of my own projects, that when you're deeply invested in a project, the information that you need to know just comes swimming towards you often. Did you have any experience like that around your book?
Yes. I'll tell you a story. So the final chapter of the book is about a series of images that were painted by Irene Champernowne in 1951, who was the director of a healing center in the English countryside. And she got moved by these images, including a UFO and two women figures on a hill. And these UFO comes down on the ground and swirls around, as one might imagine during the formation of a crop circle occurs. And she was moved by these powerful images. And fortunately for all of us, her analyst was Tony Wolfe. And so she would paint, she was an art therapist and one of the early pioneers of art therapy. She would paint these wonderful images and send them to Zurich and engage with a correspondence with Tony Wolfe or an analysis of them via letters. And so we have all this wonderful dialogue about Tony feeling that these images are impersonal. And Emma Jung, who saw them later, said that she felt there was something for them, for women in general, for people in general. And Carl Jung was so moved by one of them that he chose it for the cover of his book on UFOs. And I knew nothing of these images that where we have feminine figures and grain swirling around and UFOs until a year after I completed my thesis on crop circles at Pacifica. And I was in the library there doing a paper on Tony Wolfe, and found a memoir of Tony Wolfe, which is the pamphlet, a small, dusty pamphlet on the library shelf that no one had taken out in years, that has these images. And had I not been writing a paper on Tony Wolfe, I never would have found them, and they're the final chapter of the book now. And they really bring home everything that I had already, you know, written about the connection between these things. And it's as close as we're going to get to Jung and Emma Jung and Tony Wolfe commenting on crop circles, because the images are so similar. So, like I said, that's my synchronicity.
That's a good one. Now, you did mention that Jung's book on UFOs, and I believe he did relate that to the mandala and the symbol of the self and so on. Yeah. Did he write anything at all about crop circle phenomena?
No. Again, like this... That pamphlet is the only point of connection, and it's actually, folks can find it on the San Francisco Jung Institute webpage. I've arranged for it to be downloadable for free. It's called the Other Institute Publications on their website, and folks can see all those images. And of course, there's some in my book as well, but you can go to the San Francisco Jung Institute page and download it there. It's quite wonderful and so powerful to read their correspondence and Tony Wolfe's words about the importance of the emergence of the feminine in our time.
Yeah. And you've got a couple of websites that relate to your book and to these phenomena. And maybe this would be a good place to mention those. And I'll also put them in our show notes so that people, if they go to the site, they will find these links. You've got www.jungandcropcircles.net.
That's the book.
And you've got a Facebook page at facebook.com/Jung and Crop Circles.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And well, in the time that we have left, let's talk about your upcoming conference, which is titled Synchronicity, Matter, and Psyche. I've never done it, but I have the impression that putting on a conference is a rather huge undertaking. When did you get the idea, and why did you feel such a conference is needed?
Well, you know, I really think that our moment is about consciously coming to understand the feminine, and that includes a whole bunch of elements of our experience that our dominant institutions, our dominant culture rejects. So one of those is synchronicity and the idea of the extended mind, you know, in the work of someone like Rupert Sheldrake. And so I wanted to build a safe haven for that work to be explored. As you know, Rupert and Graham Hancock had their TED Talks pulled last spring. And so when I had the opportunity to do a conference like this, I wanted to make a safe haven for folks to come in and explore the reality of our participation in a world that exceeds, you know, the limitations that the dominant culture has placed on it. And, you know, without Rupert Sheldrake being able to be there, I don't think I would have done it, because he's a biologist and he looks at the extended mind phenomenon in humans and animals in a scientific way. So he's studied that, and he's got several great books on the topic. His newest is Science Set Free, where he questions 10 assumptions about the materialist dogma. But my favorite is The Sense of Being Stared At, where he really looks at some of the material that you were talking about, David, around, you know, the extended mind, around humans and animals' expression of behavior that is not explicable, you know, if consciousness were limited to the brain. So whether that is, you know, the movements of murmuration of birds, where, you know, they've looked at the film of that, and it's not possible for the mind to be, you know, to make the calculations fast enough for birds to move in that beautiful way. But if you look at it as a psychic field, an expression of emotion in motion, then it's possible. But it, the materialist approach to it does not, it does, the math doesn't work, you know.
I'm sorry, I don't know the word murmuration.
Oh, murmuration is when you have a flock of birds, you know, they all pop out of a tree and then move as a group.
Yes, okay. Really.
So, you know, when they've looked at the film of that, it's the coordination of movements is faster than the brain could possibly coordinate it. It's the same with fish in the ocean. You know, that group movement is not, you know, the materialist paradigm does not explain it accurately. But if we think about it as psychic fields, or as I like to think of it as emotion in motion, then we both get the coordination and the beauty.
Oh, that's fascinating. And and no, I did not know about TED Talks being pulled.
Yeah. So there's an organized, what I call, group of skeptical fundamentalists. So they're folks that really just believe that consciousness is between your ears and that's it, and they don't need to hear any other evidence and they don't need to consult anything else. They know they're right. It's essentially a religion. And so those folks behind the scenes at TED protested Rupert's talk, which was, you know, extremely uncontroversial. If folks watch it, they'll see that for themselves. And so
is it available on YouTube, perchance?
They're on YouTube. They're, you know, they've been viewed, you know, 500,000 times since they were popped back up, you know. You know, that particular TED Talk I don't think is controversial, but in the sense of being stared at, he really gets into the powerful material, like what you were talking about with the telepathy tests. And, you know, the thing you were talking about where, you know, when someone's in danger or someone dies in a war, you know, somewhere else, and the loved ones know about it, we know that through lots of different periods of history. But Rupert also looks at that connection in things like card guessing. And he looks at all the academic tests of extended mind phenomenon, and there's a tremendous amount of them, and the evidence is conclusive that, you know, consciousness does extend beyond the body. Statistically, it's quite conclusive, and there's a few interesting pieces in there that, you know, I think will fit with what you said, which was who do they find to be best at card guessing kind of telepathy tests? Well, it's people that know each other well, family members, mm-hmm. and best of all, twins.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. again, statistically reproducible, you know, clinical observation. It's not, you know, it's not loosely done.
The idea of being stared at, is that something that they tested empirically? Because
yes.
well, I'll bet you that's a pretty universal experience of feeling that you're being stared at. You yeah. turn around and somebody's staring at you.
Yes. Again, and they get statistically significant results with that. Another interesting piece they find is that people who don't believe in the possibility of the extended mind score negatively on card guessing below random chance.
Yeah, statistically significantly below
exactly.
random chance. Yeah. Yeah, that I just the previous interview I'm just remembering was with Marilyn Schlitz, who's
right.
one of the people on your program.
Yeah.
And she cited research that she's done where they ran into the same thing, that some people who are skeptical, their skepticism is leads to a result that is statistically significant in the other direction.
Yes, it proves what they don't believe in to be true.
Yes, right. That's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
And so speaking of Marilyn, she's going to be one of your presenters. And who else comes to mind? Can you give us a sense of some of the main speakers and presenters and workshops?
Sure. Sure. Well, we're really blessed. I mean, we really have an abundance of riches. I think it's, you know, one of the most significant gatherings of talent that has been assembled anywhere in a long time, to be honest. So we have Rupert Sheldrake, who's going to be speaking twice, Friday night and Saturday night, and doing a workshop on Monday morning as well. We have Graham Hancock, who's very famous, 5 million books sold, bestseller. Fingerprint of the Gods is one of his best-known books. He's going to be addressing us several times as well. We have Jill Peirce, who's a tremendous voice healing practitioner. There's a really wonderful interview with her, which folks can see on our website under the speaker video page, that's just brand new, that was done by Deepak Chopra. There's interviews with her and with Rupert by him that were just done at the end of May, in which she demonstrates her vocal technique, which is just tremendously powerful. And she's going to be working with us and offering folks a chance to experience her work. And then Richard Tarnas, who many of your listeners will be familiar with, will be there talking about synchronicity and its implications for our time. Marilyn, who you mentioned. Steven Eisenstadt, who's the founding president of Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Oh, yes, I interviewed him as well.
Yeah, I saw him in your recent interviews.
Yeah.
And then the final kind of big headliner who's there is Dr. Jim B. Tucker, who's worked at the University of Virginia for many, many years, and they've had a 30-year project there that he's inherited, where they've been studying the reincarnation stories of children, and not only recording those stories, but then going out and looking in archival records to try and find the life that the children are describing, and having great success with that, and, you know, finding details that, you know, the child's describing dying in World War II in this particular operation and this particular, you know, vehicle with this particular person, and finding all those details to be accurate in a young child. So, you know, all these things for me, again, we're not giving folks answers. We're asking questions that break you out of a paradigm that is not healthy, that is the dominant one in our society. All these figures really, each one on their own, you know, can powerfully open us up to a deeper, more satisfying view that is a mystery-filled view, that we're not giving folks answers. We're saying the dominant paradigm is insufficient, and here's why. And, you know, to have all of these folks together in one place, I just feel like it's going to be a really powerful weekend for all of us that are there. And I feel very honored to be able to share it with folks.
Yeah, well, it really sounds like quite a labor, but a labor of love. And the place is Joshua Tree, California, which is in what they call the high desert, and it's September 12, 13, and 14. What is the structure of the three-day event? I mean, is it sitting in a chair and listening to these speakers for 3 days, or?
Well, we're trying. I mean, the three basic principles that I'm trying to have, you know, inform this weekend are, one, the, you know, conscious understanding of the extended mind. The second is embodiment, you know, that we have to bring this experiences into the body. And the third is shadow recognition, and something that we find really absent quite often in the sort of West Coast consciousness scene is recognition of the shadow. But to answer your question, I think it's really important. And what we try and do as much as possible is, you know, for example, on Saturday morning, we have Rick Tarnas at 9 o'clock speaking for an hour. Then at 10 o'clock, we have a variety of embodiment or experiential practices that folks can go into, whether that's they want to explore some somatic psychology awareness or other things that involve, you know, participation and embodiment, they can do that. And then, you know, it's a mix. It's a festival style event. So sometimes we all come together and listen to, you know, Rupert or Graham speak. But oftentimes it's more a festival where you have, you know, three or four options, and, you know, yoga or something like that, that you can do so that you're not just sitting there all day long. You do have a possibility to try some things out. And we have Jill Purse's Healing Through the Voice. It's really one of the centers of the weekend, and that's Saturday at 1 o'clock. And to be able to be with her as a group and experience that powerful voice work, I think at the center of the weekend will be quite powerful for people. And then we also have a lot of panels. Like, we have a panel Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night where, you know, folks can get together and speak off the cuff. On Friday night, we have Rupert and Graham speaking together. And of course, they'll talk about their experience of being banned by Ted. And, you know, the fact that Ted really didn't have anything to say in response to them. In fact, Rupert challenged them to a debate, and nobody has taken him up on it. I think quite wisely for them, because they would lose.
Fascinating.
So there's panels every night, because for me, that's one of the most valuable things, to experience these folks speaking off the cuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's when something is new and fresh, there's a real energy to it. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Okay, well, just to give you one last opportunity here, who should attend?
Well, really everyone. I mean, we are working on CEUs for some folks, but, you know, it's really open to everyone. One of the things that I'm really proudest of is that not only do we have this amazing collection of talent for people to enjoy, but that all of the speakers, and I know, you know, personally, many of them, and I'm familiar with all their work and how they speak, all of these speakers are folks that anyone can understand. None of them, you know, speak in jargon or ways that you have to have a PhD to figure out. You know, all of these people speak in language that the average person can understand. And for me, I mean, that's a sign of, you know, where you've gone past intelligence into wisdom, where you're just speaking in a way that is accessible to everyone. That's a special kind of teacher. And I'm really, you know, very proud that those, you know, the speakers we have are that kind of people that everyone can relate to and get. And really, I think, as I said, you know, on the other side of this weekend, I think a lot of us are going to be, you know, I want to say changed, but, you know, it's given something, you know, given a new view of the world. And I think that's very powerful.
Well, that's really come through in what you've said, and I really am feeling that potential just listening to you. It sounds pretty exciting. So as we wind down now, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know, either about crop circles or the symposium or whatever?
Did we say the website for the symposium?
I'm not sure that we did. Go ahead.
It's Matter, M-A-T-T-E-R. Psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E .net, matterpsyche.net. And there is a Facebook group as well, which is facebook.com/matterpsyche. And it's Joshua Tree, September 12th to 14th, as you said.
Okay. Well, Gary S. Bobroff, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Okay, Eric, so here we are again, and another interview.
Yeah, another one.
So what thoughts are present with you right now?
Well, I'm thinking a lot about that Synchronicity Symposium. Sounds like a very special event.
Yeah, it does.
And what a place to have it. Joshua Tree is very, very powerful place there.
I've never been there. I know that I know of other events that are held there. One of my former students and friends from the past, Alberto Violdo, who teaches shamanism, and he has regular workshops there, but I've never been. You've been there to Joshua Tree?
I have visited Joshua Tree. Yeah, really, really powerful place. Anywhere in the desert. I just love going out to the desert. Yeah. So, yeah, really, really great place.
So what are your thoughts about the crop circle phenomenon that he discussed?
Well, what interests me is the symbolism of crop circles as relating to mandalas and symbols of the self. And I know that a buddy of mine and I actually have created mandalas in the sand when we go out surfing before. Actually, that's something that he does, and I more or less copied him in doing that. But the actual act of creating mandalas and the feeling that comes from that is really interesting. So looking at crop circles as these giant mandalas is really, really interesting.
And before the interview, you and I were talking about surfing because I'm intrigued that you're a surfer, and I'm jealous because I'm not a surfer and I wish I were. We were talking about the possibility that maybe there would be some kind of paper that could be written about surfing and a Jungian perspective, and you said...
Well, thinking about mindfulness and surfing, you know, it is a very, for me, it's a very spiritual activity. And thinking again about the symbolism, Jung often referred to oceans and dreams being symbols for the unconscious.
Yeah, good
and
point.
Plunging into the depths, you know, getting tossed around by a wave and getting tumbled underneath with fish and wildlife and things all around. It's so it is symbolic as well, but also very, very spiritual activity.
Yeah, me. I think the blending with the power of nature is just extraordinary. And I love watching videos and movies about surfing. Some I watched recently on Netflix where these guys get towed out into, they go searching for big waves in Australia. In particular, I mean, monster waves, right? They're hoping for a big storm and then these huge waves, and they have to get towed out with jet skis and, or what do they call the jet ski? Is that what I'm thinking of? Okay. Yeah. And I'm just amazed by all that.
Yeah, that's some pretty powerful stuff. I mean, the one that I saw was actually out in the middle of the ocean where they found a seamount. Which is just a mountain below the water, and see these massive waves come up, and you know, guys get towed by a jet ski, and they drop into these big waves. And you think about getting in sync with that natural rhythm of the ocean in a wave, and dropping into it, and riding with it.
Yeah,
you know, there's something that happens in the brain where it's not only balancing on a board, but getting into sync with this natural phenomenon of waves.
My closest understanding to that phenomenon is skiing, and I'm not intermediate skier, I guess, because I started late in life as a middle-aged guy when I got into it. But for me, it's such a beautiful activity, and learning to flow with the mountain and to flow with gravity and to experience it as your friend, to make friends with it. And you know, there's that very challenging point of when you're first learning to ski, and somewhat later too, being willing, learning that you have to be willing to point your skis downhill in order to make the turn. You're not going to be able to turn back and forth without going downhill and having the point dead down. And that's kind of a metaphor for something about life too, I think, right?
I can see that, the willingness and the courage, you know what has to happen in order to engage with nature in this way. You know, there's a little bit of courage there.
Yeah, well, particularly if you find yourself on the steep side of a slope and you're kind of stuck, and you're pointed to the your skis are pointed to the woods. You've successfully stopped, but you say, "Okay, now I've got to get going again, and I've got to turn." That can be a whole dicey operation sometimes. I would imagine that there would be analogs in surfing.
Yes, you know, it is tricky. It's a hard sport to actually get into and start to pick up, because there is an element of getting into sync and thinking about sync and synchronicity.
Yeah.
Anyways, actually getting over the fear of dropping down into a wave, mm-hmm. and being able to feel what the water is doing and respond to it in a way that is in harmony and in balance with it.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Well, we're getting far away from, maybe not that far, but we're somewhat far away from the crop circle phenomenon and Gary's book that we were discussing, but neither one of us have read yet. But I think we got a good sense of it from his presentation, which I thought was like very articulate and helped open my mind to some of the things that he's discussing. Not that they're totally unfamiliar or that I'm totally close to it, but the crop circle, you know, I was skeptical about extraterrestrials and it being an extraterrestrial landing site. But certainly he's given us a different approach, and his description of the upcoming symposium sounds very inviting.
Yes. And I liked his reference to that, that exchange between Jung and Freud and hearing the loud noise
that
Jung called out beforehand. And it brought back, it called to mind my experience studying intuition, you know, and what would seem like precognition is actually, you know, that intuitive sense and getting into tune with that.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That story, by the way, I believe is in Dreams, Memories, Reflections.
Mm-hmm.
I can never remember the order of the words. If it's Dreams, Memories, Reflections, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, I'm not sure which it is. Mm-hmm. But that's such a wonderful book, and it's been so long since I read it, I really think maybe I have to go back, because I interview people and they tell me things that are in that book, and sometimes I recognize them, and sometimes it's like, oh, totally new, I never heard that before, where did you learn that? And then they tell me it's in that book. So I think maybe we've rattled on long enough here once again.
Right.
So again, I want to thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me here. And I'm going to try to get down to that synchronicity symposium. Sounds like an event not to miss.
Yeah, I agree. And we'll see if I can get myself together to do it as well.
Looking for a way to make it personal and thank Dr. Dave? You can by paying it forward. It's easy. Just go to the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage and click on the big green donate button. You can donate a little or donate a lot, but be sure to remember to donate and to keep the programming in the green and in your ears.
Thank you, brother-in-law Mike West. And actually, it's no longer the big green donate button. As you know, it's now the multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar. So take a tip from Mike and join our family by showing your support today. I'm afraid there are no new transcript announcements today. About 3/4 of our interviews have been transcribed by listeners such as yourself. You can take a look at the transcripts page on our site, where all the transcripts and transcripts in progress are listed. Episodes you don't see there need to be transcribed. Doing a transcript is another way that you can support Shrink Wrap Radio, and people who have done it tell me it's very rewarding because, as they re-listen, they get the content at a much deeper level. Drop me an email if you'd like to take one on. The Audible.com audiobook I'm listening to right now is Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, or maybe it's Gillian, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. The reason I've taken a bit of a detour from my Nordic noir habit that I previously confessed to is that Gone Girl was recommended to me by my sister. Up to this point, all the audiobooks I've selected have had a single reader. This one has a male reader and a female reader. I guess it's because the book has two narrators, a husband and a wife. So I guess it makes sense. In general, I usually opt for books with a single reader. But hey, some flexibility is always good for the brain, right? So if you'd like to listen along with me, you can get this very same audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. I heard from listener Alexandra in Quebec, Canada, that she sometimes likes to listen to older shows, such as many that are on the Best of Shrinkwrap Radio list, on her iPhone while out and about. However, sometimes she needs to be able to scroll back or rewind a bit to re-listen to a passage, and she couldn't figure out how to do it. I wanted to make sure I understood the challenge and got together with her on the phone. And here's what we figured out. Go to the shrinkwrapradio.com website on the iPhone using the browser. Type in the number of the episodes you're looking for into the search box. It's tiny on the iPhone, so you have to do the kind of reverse pinch to enlarge it. Then when you find the episodes you're looking for, instead of pressing the play arrow, click on the download button. That will bring up the episode in a player that has both rewind and forward arrows. I don't know whether these directions will work on other smartphones, such as Android and Windows phones, so your mileage may vary.
Shrink Wrap Radio, the podcast that's always on your mind, here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Oscar. Oscar, a longtime listener, organized a dream workshop in Stockholm that I led several years ago, and we became ongoing friends as a result. I'd love to do a dream workshop in your city, so please email me if you're interested. Now let me share a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. As a matter of fact, the first one is from Oscar, whom I just mentioned, and he writes, "Hi, David. Great idea with the best of section and a nice selection. I would personally suggest you add number 279, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, with Francis Weller to the list. It still makes my heart vibrate when I think of it. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but to add some interactivity to the show, I think it would be a real treat for the listeners if they could ask questions to some of their favorite guests. I'm picturing that you either make a poll or simply intuit which guests that your listeners have reacted most positively to. Then you invite one of those guests for a follow-up interview, tell people to send in their questions, and do a listener Q&A episode with the returning guest if and when you think that you have received a sufficient number of relevant questions. The one and only downside with your aim to cover as broad a spectrum as possible is that it can leave one with a feeling that with some guests there was only time to scrape on the surface, even without listeners' involvement. Having guests return for follow-up talks in general would have my full support, especially if they are five-star or best-of guests." And then he goes on to say, "I'm thrilled, no pun intended, that you enjoy Nordic criminal novels and wanted to recommend a not-so-well-known but vastly critically acclaimed author who goes by the pseudonym of Arne Dahl. It's a series of 11 plus 3 books and counting, centering around a Swedish group of police, instead of having one single protagonist, which in itself is an ideological statement of sorts. They constitute a kind of chronicle over Sweden's development from the late 90s and forth, one book for each year, skillfully enveloped in an enjoyable page-turner style. I hold Dahl, a literature PhD, as way more interesting than Stieg Larsson, even though the latter actually was a co-worker of my mom's." Wow, I didn't know that. "I know some of them are translated, but not whether they are available as audiobooks." And that's from Oscar in Sweden. And Oscar, it's always great to hear from you, and I totally agree that the interview with Francis Weller needs to go on the best of list. And so I added it right away, thanks to your suggestion. And thanks for your suggestions about making the show more interactive. My initial impression is that it would make a lot more work for me. I don't see an easy way to implement them, quite frankly. We did give a try in the early days using Blog Talk Radio for live shows, and we just didn't have enough people showing up for that to be worthwhile. But I'll think on your suggestion. Sometimes I come around to an idea, sometimes years later, as happened with the best of list. And also, thanks for your comments about Nordic Noir recommendations. It's great to get such a recommendation from an actual Nordic Swedish person such as yourself. I've added the first in the Arne Dahl series to my Audible.com list. And also, I was fortunate to see a video series based on those Arne Dahl novels, at least some of them. And that was available here for a certain time. And now that's gone. But I look forward to checking out the books. Next, we hear from Rhonda, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Rhonda Horn. I'm a school counselor in the largest, poorest county in North Carolina. Your podcast has enriched my life exponentially. I work with At Promise high school students. I utilize what I learn from your podcast every day with my students and life. I hope you do not start charging for your podcast. As you may know, public school educators are not in the 1%. I'm going to make a long overdue contribution. Thanks, and God bless you and yours." Well, Rhonda, it's great to hear about the good work you're doing and that the podcast has helped enrich your life. I hear what you're saying about not charging for it, but I'm still considering it. Despite my pleas, there aren't enough donors to compensate all the work I'm putting into this. I keep going back and forth on this issue in my mind, but it may happen. Moving along, this next one is from Anne, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Van Nuys. I'm a psychotherapist in private practice. I have been listening to your podcast for years and did make a financial contribution recently. I really love them. I find them informative, reassuring, and deeply inspiring. I'm writing because I have, in the past few years, been using a model I've never heard mentioned on your podcast. It's called internal family systems therapy. For me, it has been life-changing both personally and professionally. It takes all of the good things we know about working with relationships between people and applies them to working with our inner relationships, the oftentimes messy conflicts we feel between different parts of ourselves. It is a loving, gentle, positive, and very deep model that really works. I find that, like EMDR, it gives me access to people's more unconscious conflicts and negative cognitions and a very clear and helpful way to heal those burdens. Its founder is Dr. Richard Schwartz. I would love to hear him or one of his trainers interviewed on your podcast. Here's a link to their website if you're interested. And the link is www.selfleadership.org. Thanks for everything you do. Warmly, Anne." Well, Anne, thanks for sharing your experience with internal family systems therapy. I was sufficiently impressed by your recommendation that I sent an interview invitation to Dr. Schwartz, but have not heard any reply yet. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. Next, we hear from Ryan, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I should have sent this earlier to maybe help you put your list together. But here's my list I've been keeping for years that I give to friends slash people I meet who might be interested in your show. Thanks again for your wonderful show." And that's signed Ryan. Well, Ryan, thank you. Your list is substantially longer than mine, which I can understand. Mine would be longer too, but I don't want it to be too intimidating to newcomers, which would defeat the purpose. However, I thought other listeners might like to see your list, so I put a link to it, and listeners can find that link at the bottom of my Best of Shrink Wrap Radio page. And by the way, thanks for helping to spread the word. I really appreciate that. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on my message phone at 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. And I'm happy to say many of you do use that app, and I encourage others to do so as well. Thanks again to Gary Bobroff for sharing his Jungian understanding of crop circles and giving us the lowdown on his upcoming Synchronicity Symposium. My next guest will be San Francisco-based psychotherapist and spiritual teacher, Dr. David Rico, who was suggested by a listener. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.